Hi everyone, I am Ali, and along with my co-host Alex, I welcome you to this episode of the Mostly Awesome Podcast, a podcast about the personal journey of innovators and change makers. We talk to doers and thinkers to understand what motivates them and why they do what they do. Today we are sitting down with Hamza Tahir. Hamza is part of the CDTM class of fall 2017 and the co-founder of ZenML. Since its inception, ZenML has raised a total funding of $6.4 million, and their mission is to empower companies to build their own specialized machine learning models, reducing dependency on API providers. Today we'll talk to Hamza about his personal journey all the way from Pakistan through CDTM and now at ZenML, sprinkled in with some questions about his outlook on the broader AI landscape. Let's jump right in.
Hamza, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for taking the time to do this, especially because it's a morning on a work day. So we really, really appreciate it. For our audience, it's a long way from Pakistan. Can you maybe tell us a story of how you came to Germany and why you came to Germany?
As you know well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to talk to the CDTM community. So yeah, I'm Hamza. I come from Pakistan, as you said, from Lahore, which is one of the biggest cities. I think, as most of us who come here, at least the people I know, the educational system was the main draw for me. So the fact that there was a quality master's program in computer science that I could go to, in a part of the world that I wanted to go to, with basically zero money, which I didn't have, right? So I couldn't afford to go to America or anything else. I think that was a sort of a no-brainer situation. So that's why it's a bit sad that it's now not the case anymore. I think it's a bit of a loss. But I think that was the main reason to come to the TUM, the Technical University of Munich, to do my master's program.
Why Munich in particular? Were there other universities in Germany that you considered?
There was Aachen and, you know, Berlin and stuff like that. But to be honest, Munich was, I had a friend of mine who was there, and I always thought that, I mean, the university is important, but from what I understood, the quality of education is sort of the similar. And I was also looking also to, you know, like found a company and do other things. And I think a bigger city with a bigger entrepreneurial scene was something I was looking for, so I selected Munich. I also didn't apply to any other city, really. I think I did Aachen, but at the end I chose Munich.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come about CDTM?
That's a good one. So I think, let me remember, I think either, like we were speaking before we were recording, that we had a lot of like Pakistani people in CDTM up till like you, Ali, and I think one of them was somebody I knew or somebody who knew somebody, and they told me about the program, and they said that if you wanted to be go into this entrepreneurial journey, this is a great place to meet the right people. Coincidentally, I was also doing other programs. I was at the Unternehmertum. I'm doing the Digital Product School, which is sort of a similar like the CDTM like programs, where I was doing a 3-month MVP. And this is where I met my co-founder, Adam. So I was already I already met my co-founder. So that was a bit weird in the sense that I knew that it wasn't really a company yet. So it was more of a project we were doing. But when I got into CDTM, Adam was also saying to me, like, you got to go there, you know, to meet the right people and to increase, you know, our visibility as well. So I think it was a very interesting thing to learn as well. So I ended up going in fall 17, and you know, it's just been so amazing to meet so many cool people since then. So yeah, it was basically people telling me to do it and me doing it.
That's pretty cool. You spoke twice about your entrepreneurial ambitions.
Yeah.
Can you maybe tell where those ambitions come from?
Where do they come from? I started my career as a software engineer, as a computer scientist, and working for this freelance company, like websites. I remember I was when I studied computer science, the first 2 years I didn't really understand why I was doing it. And then somebody told me, you should freelance, you can do IT stuff. And I was like, okay, well, I don't know what that means. And I went to all these like Fiverr. I remember Fiverr was a big thing, and Odesk or whatever it's called. And I didn't know how to really program really well. So and I didn't even want to have so much money. So I just applied for a job I thought I could do in Python or something like this. And I applied with like a bid. So you like bid for a project, and I bid for like $0. And this guy asked me, why are you applying? I mean, I said, look, I just want to learn how to do things with clients, and I just want to understand how you guys think. And he said, oh wow, okay, if you want to do this, let's do it. And then I did the job. It was some sort of scripting exercise, really really simple. And then at the end he gave me $50, and I remember I was like, oh, $50, it's like, it was really incredible. I mean, as you know, it was like, I'm talking about 8 years ago or something, 10 years ago. So for me in Pakistan as a student, $50 was like, okay, really cool that I get to spend days working on something which I really find interesting, and then I get some money at the end. And I remember with that client I worked on a few more gigs. And as I was doing my freelance journey, I think this is where I really learned that if I can dictate my own schedule and work on things that I'm really passionate about, that sort of drives me a bit more than being prescribed work. I mean, even if I couldn't not like, it's also that if I worked with a company that I believed in the vision in, it wasn't out of the crazy mind for me to do a job. It wasn't like I was super committed. But it was more like I preferred to do things on my own, to do things which I thought were pushing something forward and had a big impact. And that was where the abstract idea of entrepreneurship came from. I think from my freelance career. And in Pakistan, when I was almost about to graduate, we had a few entrepreneurial programs in Lahore, and there was a push from the government to increase that. And we had a building which came up, which was full of really cool Pakistani entrepreneurs. And I was in that environment for a year, and that also stoked some of the fire. I think it was a good time in the Pakistani entrepreneurial scene back in 2000. What was it? 14, 13, yeah.
So when you came to Germany, did you continue your freelance work, or how did you work as a working student, or what was the next move?
Yeah, I worked at Navis and Mauritius and like a few companies, also like CDTM companies, right? And I was a working student, and it was a bit different, I think, because freelancing I got to choose what I did exactly, and working student was more like a proper job, which I think it wasn't my first proper job. I did have one job in Pakistan, but like I think like really professional setting, getting to know how people work. Also, the work culture in Germany is very different, so I got to know. So that was sort of my bedding ground for understanding exactly how the work culture in Germany operates. So I'm very grateful to those opportunities as a working student. So yeah, I did a few working student positions in a few companies. I think that's a great idea, by the way, in Germany. I don't know if many countries have that. And then I did the digital product school, where I used some of the skills I picked up to build a prototype with Adam, and got into CDTM in a similar time. And that's also where the journey of the first company started.
So what was that prototype about? What was the kind of idea of the initial project that you worked on?
So Adam came from Knorr-Bremse, which is the one of the small and medium, like, well, it's not small, it's quite a big hidden giant in the German economy. They produce brakes and systems like that for the mobility industry. And he was in sales, and he was doing programs there, and he saw this really dusty old German enterprise and saw that nothing was really happening in this industry. And he wanted to, like, he had been in Manage & More, so he'd also been to Stanford and everything. So he knew that there was something should happen in this industry. So he dropped out, and he went to the Unternehmertum to find somebody to found a company with. So I didn't have the idea; it was Adam's idea, and he came with this broad, I think, picture of the fact that we have a lot of data on trucks and buses, a lot of sensor data, and we can sort of use that data for machine learning to do something. That was the broad pitch. And when we started, one of the things we thought about was, okay, we could predict when these buses and trucks would break down, because that's a big impact. And the prototype was taking a bunch of public data, which was available. There was only one public data set from Scandinavia somewhere, somebody collected some of the results, and also collecting our own data. I remember we drove out with some CAN bus recorders and went to some trucks and in back in Regensburg or something, somewhere in the outback, of some truck company. And we drove around some truck, or we had us like driven around, and we recorded some data. And we used that data. I just did some basic machine learning analysis on it, and we presented it. So it wasn't really a big deal, but it was definitely enough to get some interest also from the industry. And we had some meetings with, BMW and all those companies. So yeah, I think it was a good starting point for that enterprise.
And how did you realize that you wanted to work with Al? Not just in terms of skill, but also in terms of personality.
Yeah, it's a hard one, right? Because it's so individual. Like, is it broadly like how do you pick a co-founder? Yeah. I think the best way to pick a co-founder, I heard this from Paul Graham from on one of the podcasts, and he said something which I really resonated with me. He said, I mean, just do a project with somebody. Don't start a company with somebody. I think just the framing is very difficult. Often I see some people, also from the CDTM, they're sort of the whole framing of the relationship is where it's a co-founder relationship, and I feel like that puts too much pressure. So I never thought of Adam as my co-founder, like I'm marrying this guy for like whatever, something like a decade. But I always thought, okay, he's a cool guy, I like him, I vibe with him, and I trust him, and he seems to have the right intentions, and we have a value alignment. We have a work alignment in the sense that we want to do this. Like, it's not like he's just doing it on the side or something. He's full-time committed. He quit his job. So there was all those things, but also the fact that I never treated him until a very later point, until I worked with him as my co-founder. I think that's the best way to find a co-founder, in my opinion. Just don't start a company. Just do a project.
So you would say maybe start with a smaller initial project and kind of gauge how well you can work together and then move on to something bigger. Interesting, yeah.
Yeah. Just frame that in a short-term setting, because if you're gonna start thinking about things like, oh, what should the share split be? Or, what should the agreement be, or the stakeholder agreement? How, when are we raising? What are we raising? Who's getting what? What roles are happening? I mean, these are very big questions that it's better to have these conversations when you have an established basis of understanding with somebody. And the best way to establish that sort of understanding with somebody is to work on something that you both like, and you don't have the pressure of earning money or something. I mean, not everybody has this luxury, of course. I'm not saying that, everybody has the luxury to do 3 month tours with people, but I feel like if you do have that, then just try to lower the expectations a bit and get to the real heart of working together, just as you would in university or like in a small freelance project.
And coming from also from someone who comes from Pakistan,
Yeah.
whenever I talk to my parents, they had absolutely no idea what I'm doing here. So I tell them I'm part of CDTM, I'm doing this entrepreneurship journey, and they're very supportive, but they had no idea. I'm wondering how was it for you, and because you also mentioned you had to go back, right, out to Pakistan for some time.
So I mean, the Pakistani culture, is very family oriented, as you know, Ali. I think the individual is less important as the unit of the family. So I think the unit of the family defines the society more than the individual, which is a bit different in the West. I think there are pros and cons to both. But anyway, coming from that culture, it's very important that the children, are there. Probably, in a weird way, for some people in the West, to sacrifice more. Let's say I'm not trying to paint some grandiose picture, but there definitely is a sort of a difference of what's expected. But also, we had a really tough time in the family in the sense that my mother got very sick. She had been sick before. She had some really deep illnesses throughout my life, but she got really, really sick at that point. and my father got sick at the same time. Who and my father was like the bedrock of, or is the bedrock of the family, and he held everything together. And when he got sick, there was really nobody. And I mean, I went back. I remember I had this conversation outside of CDTM with Adam, and I asked him like, okay, what should we do? Because I feel like I'm not doing my, I don't know, like what I should be doing from my perspective. Like I feel very bad and I feel guilty that I'm not there for my family. And yeah, I just said, I think I have to go back. And he said to me, and this is, I think, one of those things that form a good co-founder relationship, is that he said, listen, you go back as long as you want, we'll figure it out, right? So that trust that he gave me was very great. I ended up going back 2, 3 months at a time. I had a lot of visa problems. I didn't know whether this was legal, what I was doing, to go away for so long. There was some challenges, but ultimately I went back for 3, 4 years. I did this, and even though they were getting well early on in this journey, but just mentally, being there, doing things around the house or just helping out, and the fact that I'm lucky enough to work in a, in this software engineering, like when we were doing that company, I could work remotely. It wasn't easy, but I could. So I think that combination sort of made me do it. I think a lot of people were telling me, hey, you have to decide. It's your company or your family. And I said, why do I have to decide? I mean, I can do it, right? I think I can do it. Even I'll get around the bureaucratic issues. I'll get around the remote working issues. I mean, if I don't try, I'm going to regret either side. And I'm very proud of that time, part of my life, because I sort of, I think I did a lot for my family, and I think they really appreciated it. And I also, we did keep the company going. I don't think we had a big impact on the material outcome of the company, even though that company didn't work out. I don't think that was because I was in Pakistan.
And just to put that into context, this was after that you did the digital product school, and then you and Adam were working
Yes,
on
yes.
Mayo, was it called?
Yes, Mayot, it was called. Very hard to say a name, which is one of the lessons I got from my first entrepreneurial stint, is to just make it an easy to say name. Yeah, I mean, that was the journey of Mayot, which was this predictive maintenance company, and I did that for 4 years with Adam.
And just to also realize, because I feel like sometimes it's just hard to understand when to give up on your company,
Yeah.
or when to know that okay, it's not working.
I
What
don't
was
think.
the sign for you yeah, this is not working and we have to try something else?
Well, materially, COVID was the sign. COVID was the sign because COVID wrecked. I think we had like a 500,000 contract for some company coming up, and that just fell through because of COVID. So, but it was honestly, there were many problems internally, in the sense that we all knew that it was not going anywhere. It wasn't growing because, the what is that really defining a startup? A startup is not a slow growing company, and Mayot was a slow growing company, or barely any growth. We were doing projects. It was very nice, and we had money in the sense that we could keep going, but the growth was, not there. And it's very hard to get out of that rut, like this like zombie startup syndrome. I definitely suffered that, like slowly going into the death. And I often I talked to Adam about this. Maybe it would have been better if we'd died a bit earlier. But at the same time, the counter argument is that those 4 years were sort of the foundation of the way I think about entrepreneurship. And it was, I don't think I would take back those 4 years, in the sense how much I learned. And probably there's I maybe I would have learned more if it was a 1 year stint, and then I would have moved on to the next thing. But at the end, I'm just happy how it turned out. The sign was essentially COVID. The project went out. We ran out of money. And there was a moment where we had this idea of ZenML. It wasn't really there. And ZenML, which is what I'm founding now, we hadn't really raised venture capital for Mayot. It was all bootstrapped, except for some pre-seed money that we paid back eventually. But that idea was born from sort of the experiences we had with Mayotte, which was, at Mayotte we were doing a lot of machine learning, and we knew that machine learning was or artificial intelligence models were very hard to productionalize. They were very hard to deploy in a robust way. And data scientists who actually build these models are very far away from the engineering discipline where I also came from. So machine learning engineering and machine learning operationalization was becoming a bigger topic. And from that, we took some of the work we've done from different projects, and we made this idea of XenML. And this idea carried forward into the next company, and we put all of our bets into it, all of our eggs in one basket. We were like, okay, this is gonna work or not. And we open sourced it, and then we closed the previous company, started a new one, and we raised on that new one. And the new and in the period where literally the bank account hit zero, we put in our own personal money. We were just going to just keep going, and we finally got a term sheet. And then that was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. And yeah, it was a very, very close call. We were very close to just, I mean, I don't even, the, I mean, I, it's not your question, but I just sometimes I wonder. I'd never even thought about it not working out, because I think if I'd lingered on that, it would have been like such a disaster to think, okay, 4 years and now we just spent like months raising and now it didn't work out. What am I supposed to do now? But luckily, the term sheet came in. We only had one or two, so it was. Yeah, it was a good journey.
So how did the MVP for XenML look like? What was the functionality, I guess, that you initially came up with?
Yeah, so we early on decided to open source it. That was also why it was fundamentally different from Mayotte. Mayotte was just building models for people, and this was more like the foundational framework, which we open sourced. So we the MVP was a pipelining system which allowed data scientists to write an end-to-end pipeline of machine learning from loading the data to training the model. And I think it was also running it on big data sets and deploying it. Very, very hacky, very limited in what it could do. XenML doesn't look anything like it was, right? So it was this, but anyway, the vision of XenML was always sort of consistent that we didn't want to do anything which, like, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel of this. We just wanted to bring things together that already existed. I think that vision has resonated for the last 2 years in the market, because there's many machine learning tools, but not a lot of them think about how do we combine these things into something that forms a coherent picture. And I think just because of that vision, even though the functionality wasn't there, I think a lot of data scientists and ML engineers gravitated towards that. We got like 1,300 GitHub stars or something, and we wanted to get above 1,000 GitHub stars. That was the metric. And I don't know if that would have been enough today to raise. Probably not, because the market changed. In 2019, it was different. Or 2021, it was different. So I think it's that was enough back in the day to tell a story that, listen, there's some resonance. But we also had a project with a large defense and aerospace company in Europe, and we were getting paid by them. So that paid contract, 1,300 GitHub stars, the story that was what we raised on.
Now going back to the product, I remember during our MyCDTM interview, at least, probably also happened to you, we had to answer this question of explaining the technology to your grandfather. Did you have that question?
I don't know. It was more like telling me a joke.
So we had this question. So we had to explain our technology to your grandfather, and I'm now going to ask you to explain XenML to all of the people who don't understand the jargon of machine learning.
I've been asked this before, so I'm a bit prepared.
Oh, nice.
No, like to my own mother and father, I have to do this, right? So I think of, like, here's the best way I can explain it. So think of data scientists, the people who actually produce artificial intelligence in the world. Think of them as chefs, and they're cooking a meal. And what we're doing is we are providing all the tools that they need to go from the cutting board to the oven or to the stove, and putting it right in front of the customer in a restaurant. So we are providing them the facade of standardized way of going, cutting a piece of sushi to getting it on a sushi platter out there, and they don't have to think about what are the intricacies of the material of the cutting board or the gas stove, how it functions and all that. All those things are, the gas stove is maybe the infrastructure, like which is running training. That could be GCP or AWS or something, right? The cutting board material could be where the data is stored, which could be Snowflake or some sort of database that you want to read data from. And maybe the plate that you're using, it's warmed up enough that the food doesn't get cold. That could be the deployment where maybe you use something like Hugging Face to deploy it. So we are providing them the tools and the standard interfaces to make sure that meals can flow out of the kitchen as fast as possible. And the faster meals flow out of the kitchen, the faster the world is happy because they get to consume machine learning models.
So to go a little bit more into the technical details, the way I understand it is you write adapters to different APIs and then abstract away from these specific APIs so that you can run a machine learning pipeline on any kind of infrastructure. Is that kind of the key functionality? Or if not, what are some other functionalities of XenML?
I think so. That's a big part of it. And I think, like XenML at its core, what it does is there's the application pipelining layer of machine learning, and then there's the infrastructure layer. And oftentimes, when you write machine learning code, you tie these two things together. Let's say if you want to run a pipeline on a local laptop, that's quite different from writing something that runs on Databricks or on SageMaker, AWS SageMaker pipelines, or Airflow or Kubeflow or something like that. So fundamentally, what we're doing is we're saying, okay, that doesn't need to be the case. Like, you don't need to tie the way you write your code to the target infrastructure where it will be deployed, just like you said. So that definitely is the USP. And in terms of if we do that, there are many things that we get away from classically, right? So if, like, I think classically the people who solve this problem are the orchestration tools like Airflow and Kubeflow. The problem is because they're tied to the infrastructure, they either focus their focus is mostly on the infrastructure provisioning side, which is an art and science in itself, right? How to provision a GPU, how to provision eight of them, how to train something like ChatGPT. Like, that's a whole discipline in itself. But for us, it's more on the layer on top, the experience layer, about the developer experience. And also, there's a lot of things that happen in the development of machine learning models, like tracking the metadata of a model or comparing the metrics of a model. We can then solve those things a lot better natively into the workflow, and then still offer the advantage of deploying to some of that orchestration infrastructure. I think the combination of just having the focus of the company just be on providing a great experience on top and abstracting away that has been always the goal of XenML. And I think fundamentally that is what sets us apart from something like Airflow or orchestrators of that ilk.
So the idea is that you can write really simple code and then that is very clean and beautiful. Cool, yeah. And so can you go a little bit more into maybe like what are the essential parts of a pipeline, maybe for people that don't understand how does it work if you have a machine learning pipeline?
So a machine learning pipeline consists of many different stack components and many different things that you'd want to do. So classically, you would think of a pipeline as loading some data, pre-processing it, and training model. Oftentimes, what you also want to do is you want to actually, let's stick on that. Let's stick on that simple paradigm. So when you go through that paradigm, you're producing transformations of data that are very important to keep a track of. So a pipeline fundamentally is just like, think of it as a queue, and you're just, when you stop at a station, something changes and that gets passed on to the other station. And it's very important to provide a lineage of all of that. So that's something where there's an artifact layer to it. So there's an artifact storage where you store your artifacts. Where do you store that? Is that in a Google Drive? Is that in a zipped folder in your computer? Is that in an S3 bucket? And then there's the orchestration, which is, where does it run? Is it running on your local machine? Is it running on a Docker image somewhere? Is it running on the cloud somewhere? So an orchestrator and an artifact store is the fundamental pieces of what you need to think about when you're thinking about machine learning pipelines. And then you have all of these optional components on top, which are you doing an experiment in your pipeline? Okay. Oftentimes data scientists frame those things as experiments. Like, okay, I changed a hyperparameter. That's an experiment. And I want to track my experiment. So we have something called an experiment tracker, like MLflow. Then we have things like alerters, like things that alert when things happen. Then we have things like model deployers. So when model is trained, you automatically deploy it. We have a model registry component, which is a big part of machine learning, which is when a model is trained, you put it in a central register so that you with a name and a description and a model card, so you can also figure out its biases and what it was trained on for reproducibility and for auditability and also for all of this governance that you have. So there's a few moving parts, but I think the important thing is that you start off with the basic idea of structuring your code in a certain way. I think oftentimes code starts in a spaghetti Jupyter notebook sort of style in machine learning, and that's is one of the hardest things to overcome is how do you structure that into a clean Pythonic, mostly Pythonic function-based system. And you can add those components on top.
So switching gears a little bit, can you talk a little more about how the fundraising process went for ZenML and what were some perhaps tricks or some useful tips for people who are currently fundraising or are looking into fundraising?
Tricks. Believe in your own hype. I think VCs are very good at smelling out lack of confidence or bullshit. So they're, I mean, if they're good at anything, they're good at smelling out that. So that's what they're looking at. I mean, when they're looking at you, they're really, you know what they're trying to gauge are really good ones I'm talking about. They're not trying to look at, is this guy smart enough to execute this idea for a certain audience? I mean, pretty much most of the time they establish that very quickly. But what they're trying to suss out really is, can this guy be the CEO or the CTO or the whatever CEO of a $1 billion enterprise? And I think the way you talk and act and think should reflect that. You should almost think of yourself as like 10 years down the line and everything worked out. And if you talk in that sense, I think most of the time good VCs will, you know, there's a certain amount of data you can show them that will probably convince them, but good VCs also know that this is a risky thing that they're doing. And a lot of the time they're investing in you and the idea versus more data point. I mean, the more data points you give them, the better. But at the end of the day, the story has to resonate and needs to make sense to their worldview. So if I was to summarize it, I think my fundraising process was you start fundraising, you talk to like 50 to 100 VCs, and you, I think by point number 30, you start to see a pattern of how these people think, because there's a certain category of people, right? Like it's like talking to bureaucrats or diplomats, or like it's after you talk to 30, it's like you sort of get a feel, you get a feeling for how they think. And I think it's very important to get a feeling, because I remember the first time I talked to some VC, they invited us to an office and we were going there and they were like, I was super like, wow, what is this? And then after you were like, okay, just let's take a remote call. Let's do a 15-minute chat, you know, because they're always going to take a meeting with you, and that's their job. Your job is to optimize your time. It's very overwhelming to raise, I believe, because you have to talk to 50 to 100, maybe more people, and that's just one meeting is 30 minutes, so you can just map that. You probably have many meetings until a term sheet. So you really got to be organized. I would suggest that you make a pipeline and put down who you're talking to. Adam was good at that. He led the process, but every time you just use an Excel or some software, a CRM, to see, okay, who did you talk to? Where are they in the process? Who am I going to keep in touch with? What am I going to send them? Have your materials prepped. You need a pitch deck. You need some sort of data room situation. So you need some sort of Google Drive where you have some of the numbers and figures uploaded. These are maybe a bit more practical than you're thinking, but I guess these are the things that I learned. And when you're talking to them, get to the root of the, like, try to establish first an understanding that your worldviews are aligned. That should be the first 15, 20 minutes. Like, are you just even aligned on the language you're using? And then see, okay, where do you carve out the market segment? And you should pitch that story that way. So try to get into their worldview rather than pitching yours.
As we sit at your beautiful office at Schillingstrasse, you mentioned that you're already 14 employees strong. How challenging was it to find good AI talent?
Especially in Germany, where there's a smaller market, I guess, for AI talent.
I think it's we were very lucky to find very talented engineers, and I don't know if it's necessarily true that Europe has less talent than I'm assuming you're comparing it to the US. I just feel like there's a lot of, let's say, people are less confident in Europe, but from my understanding, I think the only real difference is more the marketing side of things in America is better than the talent side. So for me, we hired a recruiter who was very good, and this is something that I never go before doing that. I thought this is not a good idea, but after doing that, I mean, he really helped us a lot as well, just to find really stellar talent. And also because we were working in open source, we had this wide field of people who were just attracted naturally to the project. And they could feel it and suss it out. So open source really helps in recruiting, right? Like open source is like, it's the best thing to just tell an engineer, hey, this is our product. Go test it out. If you like it, come back. I've done that with so many hires. So I think you automatically find the people with the who might not be the most experienced people. I mean, I don't even need 10 years of your experience. If you have like even 2 years of experience, but you really understand that problem that we're solving and you use the product and you have a clear, articulate way of saying, wow, I know exactly what you're doing and I know where to take this company in the next 5 years. Being open source is the best way to do that. And I was very lucky to find, I mean, our team is full of engineers, like 10, 12 engineers. And all of these engineers have this mindset. Some of them are more experienced than others. Some of them have built ML platforms in big companies. Some of them are just did one ML job and then joined us. But all of them have this shared vision and understanding of the problem space and want to push the boundaries of that. So it wasn't that hard. But I also think I'm taking a bit for granted that we had a very strict process as well. Like we also really had a high bar for these things. So maybe that's a tip that don't, I mean, for example, I was struggling to hire a front-end engineer for months, and an easy out would be to just lower the bar and just get one because we need one in the company. But if you just wait it out and find the right person of the right mindset and the right skill set, I think it's inevitably better. So just be patient in hiring. That's important.
Did you have a lot of people who joined your company that were former contributors on GitHub, or did you just, or do you mean more like you send them the link on GitHub and then they check out the project and that's why they're inspired?
We had both cases, but more the latter because at the time it was a young project, so there was nothing to contribute to really so much. It was more, but just the fact that you could send it and they could see the code base. I mean, all good engineers go through exactly the code base. They see the code standard, and they hold you accountable for that, right? And take you seriously if you take that seriously. But we've had many contributors applying as well.
Cool, yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the future of AI. Where do you see these models in at the rapid pace at which they're developing? Where do you see them in, say, 3 to 5 years? How do you see the future in that sense?
Yeah, we're doomed. It's over. It's over. No. I mean, look, like, I mean, these models are very good at doing narrow intelligence. And I would consider ChatGPT as more narrow intelligence because it's good at some things than others. I think this whole concept of AI doomers and like saying that the world will end in like 3 to 5 years, I firmly disagree with that, even accounting for maybe this Q star thing that happened at OpenAI and whatever. I really don't believe in the hype so much. Maybe because I just know how these things are trained, and I mean ChatGPT is fundamentally it's just predicting the next word. And I'm in that camp of people who don't think that this is intrinsically there's any reasoning happening. However, if you go beyond that hype of, okay, this is going to take over the world, like Terminator style, but if you look at the amount of job impact it would have, like how many jobs are going to go out and how many jobs are going to evolve, I do believe in that hype. So I'm a firm believer that we are going through a platform shift, not dissimilar to the cloud shift that happened in the internet, where everybody went on cloud infrastructure, everybody was building their own data centers, they started using managed infrastructure, or maybe even at par with the invention of the internet itself. I do believe that's as big. I did not believe in this with cryptocurrencies, with blockchain and all of this previous stuff, but with this particular thing,
I think this is different.
I think this fundamentally different because it fundamentally it changes the way our economy functions in the sense that the internet is fundamentally was an index economy, like the websites that one with indexing things like Google search and Amazon and everything you look at the like Craigslist, everything is an index, right? So everything is basically, okay, I have looked at these websites before and I've curated this list for you. Hey, this is easy for you. And the job of humans was, okay, I have these indices available, and all my job is now to find out the right things from all these indices. And if I do that better than other people, then I have an edge, right? This used to be the internet economy. Before that, there was no index, and there was a different world. Then there is an index. Now we're going beyond an index, right? It's more of a creative economy. Like we're looking at a world where, I mean, the index doesn't exist, but you need to prompt something to get some knowledge out. And fundamentally, you need to create things to achieve that edge that we used to have with the index economy. And I think that's fundamentally going to change how the office functions, how the workplace functions. And I believe that a lot of jobs will change, like lawyers and doctors and tax consultants and all these. And I think this is going to be a mega, mega, mega like shift. Like in half a decade, probably we'll see a world that we probably could not recognize from today's standards.
So do you see it more as a symbiosis of people and machines, or do you think that at some point there will be a point where it makes less sense to train another human than to train another AI, and then the economics kind of push more towards automation and we have, say, massive job loss, for example? How do you see it?
Economics always pushes towards automation. So I feel like it will be a symbiosis in the sense that I don't think humans will do the same jobs as they did before. They will do different jobs, but they will be still in charge of using these tools. So fundamentally what we have is just, I don't know, it's like hiring me 10 years ago. Like I told you about the story. Like I mean, for me, from the perspective of the guy who hired me, he was sitting in Chicago. For him, it was $50 he gives a dude, and this dude gives him some ROI on some LinkedIn script that I wrote for him. And it's like hiring somebody on Fiverr, basically, right? And it's just free and it's faster and it's 100x better. And the people who are going to win are going to be the people who understood back in the early 2000s that computers are going to be a thing and we should better learn computers. I mean, my father, he bought a computer and he retrained himself. He was a doctor. He went and he worked at UNICEF. And I remember he got me into computers because he bought the first Pentium One and the first whatever. And he started looking, okay, what is this thing? I have to click around and do Word and Excel. And the fact that he trained himself was the reason he progressed in his job. And a lot of his peers did not, and they did not, right? So I think he was like 40 when he did this. And I think people who are 30 and 40 and just right now better start paying attention.
Maybe zoning in on this perspective, that the future of AI would change the landscape of jobs, because I think it's super relevant. What advice would you give to people so that they can have skills that are still relevant in this future?
The skills that are still relevant are going to be skills which are fundamentally creative in nature. So I think what we need to get away from, just like kids nowadays, they don't accrue knowledge because they have knowledge at the like it's a Google away, but they still need to be smart, right? And they're smart by by parsing information in a different way and creating their own knowledge index in their brain. I think the advice is the same as it's always been. Like, read a lot of things, learn a lot of things, be a lifelong learner. Never take for granted that the tools that you're using in your daily life are not going to change, or your field is not going to change. It's going to change faster than you ever had experience of it before. So if there's one skill you need to pick up, it's learning. Like, Charlie Munger passed away a few days ago. Henry Kissinger passed away a few days ago. And I think these people were lifelong learners, no matter what you think of them. And Charlie Munger himself, he said that, and I really, in the Buffett Munger camp, I find myself agreeing with a lot of what they say. And I think he really convinced me that even at freaking 99 years old, this guy was learning about stocks. So if Charlie Munger is still learning about stocks at 99, then if you're a 25-year-old, you better be prepared for a lifetime of just Googling things and learning, or asking ChatGPT.
That's really good advice.
Don't know.
Yeah, then maybe the more general question that I guess you thought we would ask, and here it is. When do you think we will have an intelligence that surpasses human abilities in all aspects, mathematics, reasoning, and all in a general sense?
It's hard to predict the future. I don't think we will have it very soon, unlike many other people. One of the smartest people I've ever talked to is Jim Keller, who's the founder of Tenstorrent, and he did all the he did he designed the M1 chip and all the architecture Tesla, and he's very fundamentally very first principle thinker. And he worked under Elon Musk and Steve Jobs, so he has a very interesting perspective on how to view things. And he and I had a discussion, and this is one of the most thought-provoking discussions I probably ever had, and I really enjoyed talking to him. I was lucky to talk to him. And he and I both were sort of thinking, I mean, like, he had a little daughter, and he said to me, "I have a little daughter. It's not like she bangs my car in my garage door for like 100 times before she learns not to do that. Or it's not like she puts her hand on the stove 1,000 times and then she understands that, okay, I don't need to put my hand on the stove anymore. Probably once is enough, or maybe even not even once. Maybe just fundamentally understanding that it's very hot, you shouldn't touch it." So humans don't learn the way these models do, right? These models are fundamentally banging their heads against the wall, and somehow blindly they find something and it works, and we reward them for that. So I feel like backpropagation is not the way to solve general intelligence. I don't think that solving a gradient function is how humans function, fundamentally, just very fundamentally. And most machine learning research, even this Q-star stuff, if you look at it, which is somehow the next breakthrough, is fundamentally not solving the right whatever equation of consciousness we have. In my opinion, I feel like we don't just regress and learn things based on examples. I feel like there's something more and special. Maybe it's not even a mathematical computation, to be honest. I don't know fundamentally what's happening and whether we can even mathematically solve it. So in that very first principle based thinking, I would say we're very far away. We're as far away as we ever were, to be honest. I don't think ChatGPT changed my mind on that. So maybe I'm not in the normal camp for that, but
So you would say the constraint is more the model architecture than the amount of compute, or do you think
yeah.
both of these
I
work?
mean, let's put it this way. If it turns out that humans and the way I think and you both think, if it turns out that we're just a big, big fat neural network that predicts the next word, then I would be fundamentally very sad.
Well, and so what do you think in case that we ever develop such a system, which in your opinion is quite far away into the
It could
future,
happen though.
what do you think like the probability of some really terrible outcome is? What do you think that where would you assign these probabilities?
So terrible is a relative word. So I
So
think,
suppose something in the
yeah,
order of
terrible in
human
terms of
extinction.
humans, you mean.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think species go in and out of extinction.
That's what our listeners want to hear.
So I think whatever comes out of that might be, they might think of us as we think of Neanderthals or whatever. So, I mean, whatever happens is the course of nature, and I would say let's not dwell on that too much. And I do think it if we have a super intelligent being, that is how you describe it, I don't think that's good for humans. So they'll have to upgrade. So they either have to fuse with them, which would be the equivalent of reproducing with them, or they go out of existence, which is a bit sad to hear. But I don't think you can control such a thing fundamentally.
Well, that's quite a sad note. But maybe
it's far away, people. I don't think we're there yet. But and maybe we just level up generally.
Right.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask you about a future, but a different kind of future. Coming back now to Pakistan.
Oh yeah.
What do you think about the future of startups, and also in terms of like entrepreneurial ambitions? People, I think in Pakistan, like from my personal experience, we don't yet have that much of an infrastructure to support it.
No.
Are you optimistic about the future there?
I'm not optimistic, man. I'm so sad. My heart mourns for Pakistan. When I was there, like, when did you leave?
2 years ago.
2 years ago. You have more of a pulse on it than I do. I would be interested in your view. But I'm very sad about what happened to the country. I think that a lot of it is nothing to do with the talent there or the way people think. I've met some of the smartest people that I've ever met in my life in Pakistan. It's just that they're held back by this political landscape that is just devolving every year. And I think if you don't have institutions you can rely on and politics you can rely on, this country is great, because no matter what happens, whether it's a global pandemic or whether whatever, you still can rely on the institutions that they will work and function. I mean, we had a huge snowstorm a few days ago, and now the city is clear. That's great. These are the things that are the bedrock of entrepreneurship. So entrepreneurship flourishes still at a different scale in Pakistan. People build things, people innovate. But if you're talking about tech entrepreneurship and being on a global scale, I feel like we've regressed in the last half a decade rather than gone up. And if you asked me half a decade ago, I would have said, oh, it's going to be a great economy. But so it's been not how I expected it. But I'd be curious about your view on it.
I think I totally agree with that. I remember from my class, almost 80% of the people left the country. Many of them also had these dreams of starting something or doing something. Yeah. And after a couple of years of working there, they were all disillusioned and they left the country. Yeah. So I totally agree with this idea that it has regressed in the last 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
But would you ever go back and invest, especially after you get the exit from the NMF?
The exit. Yeah, why not? I mean, I think the politics and the people have to be rowing in a certain direction, because I'm not a politician, and I'm not good at managing that sort of people, I think. So I can't change that. So, but maybe that's a cop-out answer. Maybe we should be the people going back and fixing the country. So I have to think about that deeper.
Yeah, I ask the same questions. I have no answer as well.
It's no answer.
Well, maybe on a closing note, what is something or somebody that really helped you in your entrepreneurial journey, something that was really some kind of bedrock for you?
I don't think there's any one, but I often go back to Paul Graham's writings a lot. I mean, maybe that's a very classical answer, but I do resonate with, he's very smart, isn't he? I don't know about you, but I read a lot of his essays. When I'm in a down mode and I don't know what to do, and if there's some fundamental thing, I read paulgraham.com and his essays, and sometimes I think he rereads his own essays, so he's maybe
I think he has a lot of,
so I think he's inspired me a lot, Paul Graham. And I think that's really the guy who's for me entrepreneurially, I believe in his, the way he thinks about the world.
Do you think, what is your favorite Paul Graham essay, Hackers and Painters, or?
Yeah, all of them. There's no favorite one. But there was one about where he motivates people to live a great life and be exceptional. And he just, the way he talks about it is just so basic. Like, you just understand. Like, he's just saying, okay, hey, if you first of all decide if you want to be really, really good at something and great at something, and then these are the consequences of that, and people are going to tell you these things about that journey, and people are going to think you're crazy, but you have to just accept those things and move forward. So fundamentally, summarizing it's quite easy, but when you read the words, they really hit you. If you've ever tried to achieve something where people have told you, and you're coming from Pakistan, I think this is something that happens a lot, told you that this is a silly like dream that you have, I think then that essay really, I'll send around the link if you have notes. I think that's one of my favorite ones.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah, one final question. We have a tradition at our Mostly Awesome podcast that we ask you to forward a question to the next guest. And since you're the first guest on our new season, what question would you like to forward?
Oh, that's a good one. What question would I like to ask somebody? So I think one good one is, what advice would you give your younger self? Let's ask that. I think that's always reveals a lot.
That is a good question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, looking forward to the answer in the next episode.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Yeah, thank you so much for Thanks doing so this. Much. It was a really interesting conversation. Mm-hmm. Good luck with your journey with ZenML and everything. And everyone is rooting for you.
Thank you very much. Good luck for you guys.